Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of The Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Terence Corrigan. Today, we're going to be looking into what makes political polling good, bad, and everything in between. We're also going to be talking a little bit about getting local government to work in a new exciting webinar discussing how that could happen. We're going to be talking a little bit more about new details on the ANC's electoral lists and the chaos of leaving some of their most prominent candidates off of those lists. And lastly, we're going to sum up, we're going to talk about a story involving South African soldiers being forced to donate money to people in Cuba. So before we jump into it, I just want to say, please do, if you're interested in all the stuff being put out by the dailyfriend.co.za, not just the podcast, but also all of the writing from the many varied opinion writers with many perspectives we have on the dailyfriend.co.za, do follow our WhatsApp channel. Probably the easiest, least cluttered way to follow us on social media and get access to all of that stuff. So we'll put a link to that in the description of the show. Right, so let's start off with this first story. This is from the Daily Maverick. This is a piece by Ferial Hafaji reporting on this poll by Ipsos. It's titled ANC and DA in Dead Heat Across the Key Metros as MK Dominates Etegwini. So seeing that headline, you think, okay, well, that seems pretty consistent with what we expected. Nothing too surprising there. This poll has some top-line numbers saying things like nationally the ANC is at 31% and the DA is at 25%, with MK at 14%, the EFF at 11%, Action SA at 6%, and some of the other parties less than that. Now, you know, one can quibble here or there with those top-line numbers, but that seems broadly in line with what other polling has shown up till now. But when you start to dig into the details, you get really weird things. So, for example, it shows the ANC as being slightly ahead of the DA in Joburg, something that runs contrary to a lot of polls we've had before, up till now. Okay, but I suppose it's possible. But then you start to get extremely weird results. Like, apparently, according to this poll, the DA is ahead of the ANC in Buffalo City, formerly known as East London. Huh? The DA is going to lose its majority in Cape Town, but it's going to be the biggest party in Bloemfontein? That seems very strange. That seems kind of difficult to believe that there would be such an uneven swing. When voters change direction, they often do it on quite a wide scale. We don't usually get super local pockets. Sometimes you do, but it's rare to see it on this sort of scale. Then you go and you look at the bottom of the article, and it lists margins of error, which is a thing that's in all polls, where each result can be up or down by a certain percentage points and still be kind of within the methodology of the poll. You see that the margin of error for some of these places listed is insane. Johannesburg, the margin of error was 5.5. That means that every single result that was found in that poll could be 5 points up or down from the listed one. Then it gets even crazier. There's a 15% margin of error for East London and Bloemfontein. I think that that makes the poll essentially meaningless, because if you could be 15 points out, that's the difference between the DA getting 15% and 30%, for example, in Bloemfontein, which makes this kind of really difficult. So when we saw that, me and some of the colleagues started talking about this, and we said this doesn't look right. Now, Ipsos is one of the big polling companies. It has a good reputation. They poll all over the world. Their poll sample size is described in that Daily Maverick story as being the biggest in the country, 3,600 randomly selected respondents. However, as pollster Gareth von Onselen points out, there's all sorts of problems when you start to look into the methodology here. The poll contains 3,600 randomly selected respondents, and that, quote, filters were applied to isolate the group of respondents who are registered to vote. But we don't know how many were excluded in the final sample, which means that the sample could be a lot smaller than 3,600 randomly selected people. Okay, but it still means that you can have a decent sample size, even if you excluded, I don't know, 1,000 people from that, or more. But then it turns out that they didn't do individual polls for each of these cities. They just looked at the respondents in the polls. They looked at the subsamples. When you look at the subsamples in a representative poll, your margin of error increases dramatically, which Gareth lays out. He also says that they then asked people in a really poor way about whether they're going to turn out. Asking people whether they're going to vote produces a very unreliable answer because people don't—they're not very honest. They'll say they are going to vote even when they're not. He says that the polls that he's done—they ask sometimes 8 to 10 questions in order to work out the likelihood someone is going to vote. Ipsos apparently in this poll only asked, "Are you going to vote or not?" The conclusion being that this thing seems kind of unreliable. I don't know, Terence. What do you make of this story? And if Ipsos isn't giving us polls that we can take super seriously, then that means that basically the SRF seems to be the only game in town at the moment.
Yeah. A couple of years ago, some of our polling was questioned by a semi well-known activist on television talking about those bogus polls. I was less perturbed about what she was saying than about the lack of any kind of pushback from the host. This is around the same time there had been another article, also in the Daily Maverick, that had challenged our polls on a methodological basis. And they said, they only asked 2,400 people. Well, 2,400 people, that's it doesn't really get very much better. I think you need a representative sample can be done with about 600, and that's in a country like America. It starts to become less and less accurate as you try to extrapolate those to smaller areas. Point is that the question of methodological problems is one that is often thrown up by people to cast shade on a particular on a particular opinion poll in the hope that they're not going to actually have to justify it because, after all, if you know that there's a methodological problem and you're speaking to people who don't understand the methodology or you assume don't understand the methodology, well, you don't have to understand it either because, I think we're too embarrassed to ask. This is a very rare example where someone who actually does get methodology came back and said, no, there's a methodological problem. That being said, the global figure probably seems more or less where one would
Close to
expect.
right, yeah.
But for a journalist writing at this point, and I must say, I have the highest regard for Ferial Hafagee as a journalist. I think she's one of South Africa's best, but she needs copy. And the game she's following is the election trail. This is a story too good not to write up. But there again, I think that it's important to understand exactly what you're looking at. A point that Gareth van Onselen didn't mention is that part of the Ipsos methodology is in person, which would seem to be a good thing. But I think that one of the problems with that is that you're effectively excluded from things like walled estates, which is a big factor in cities. Even a lot of suburban communities, just the idea, hi, I'm the guy with a clipboard. I'd like to talk to you. And it's like, no, you don't get to come in here because we're all scared that you're going to come in and rob me. Apparently there's a scam going around with people coming to inspect your TV license, which I think they last did in the 1990s. I remember encountering those guys once or twice. I think that there's a limit to what you can read into this. That being said, I think that for the that if I was in a position of authority in Ipsos, I would try and argue back on those methodological questions. If they don't, that raises questions about, or unresolved questions about the reliability of this particular poll. And you know, as you said, Ipsos it's not a fly by night operation. It's it's an acknowledged one. I see that on social media there's something I think called the Ipsos electoral poll, which claims that the Truth and Solidarity movement is going to win both Cape Town and Johannesburg. I would say take that with caution.
Yes, one of our colleagues posted a screenshot that's going around on social media of this group that none of us have ever heard of, that has obviously used AI to generate what looks like an official screenshot from a news station, showing that they're going to this party no one's ever heard of is going to win elections. So there's a lot of fake polls out there. This is definitely not a fake poll from Ipsos, but there are some big questions about whether it's a useful poll and whether it was actually satisfying what we want to know. As our elections become more competitive, it kind of gets more difficult for polling to really nail it down. All polls, and this is a thing that often happens, is in these very competitive elections, like, for example, in the US presidential elections, or like the Brexit referendum back in 2016, people say, well, the polls were wrong. Well, you say, okay, but actually, when you look at their margins of error and how polls can never get it exactly right, they're always a few percentage points up or down from the actual result, even if they're perfectly done. Once you get an election that's really close, it actually is kind of impossible to get precise numbers from polling, in the sense that, when the difference of a few percentage points can make or break the control of a city, for example, if the DA gets 47% of the vote, it's going to be very different to if it gets 51% of the vote, let's say in Johannesburg, right? So once you get that close, things kind of start to break down and polling reaches its limits, so you can't actually take it that far. But I think this one is, those Bloemfontein results can just be completely written off. Even the Joburg results in this poll are dodgy at best, with a margin of error of 5.5%. I think that makes it very difficult to get a useful picture from them, which is sad, because I think South Africa desperately needs more political polling. I think the Common Sense SRF polls have been really good for the country. Beforehand, we just had an occasional one from Ipsos, and sometimes other organizations, I think the ENCA and the Brenthurst Foundation, other ones do things, but we don't have a diet of it. And I think it worsens our political commentary because people often then just suck things out of their thumb rather than responding to what's actually going on. Any final thoughts on this?
Well, I'm always reminded of something that Tony Leon said back in the 1990s in a Lifestyle TV interview, that after the 1994 election results came in, apparently spoke to his father and he said, "I don't understand. Everyone I knew was going to vote for the DP." And he said, "Well, Dad, you know 100 people." And until you actually walk in, and until the last person has made an X on the paper, we just don't know. And that is really the poll that counts.
Exactly. Okay. On to our next story. Terence, you, in discussion with a number of experts and academics, are going to be launching a new paper through a webinar this week on local government. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, South Africa is heading towards what, dare I say, it could be a watershed, to use the cliche. A watershed local government election. Question, though, is what happens the day after and what happens in the five years following. And I think the big consideration there is that changing municipal leadership does not resolve all the problems. South Africa's municipal system is now close to three decades old. 26 years, if you discount the 1990s, if you want to take the 1990s as kind of the proto municipal system, then we're on three decades. And what we have seen is a growing consensus amongst experts, most recently even acknowledged by the new white paper on local government, that the system is not really fit for purpose. In the 1990s, the process that led to the current system, what was intended was, or what was envisaged was, this wall-to-wall system of local government. So, you know, everything from Cape Town and you know, metropolitan areas through to the sort of deep rural parts, with, I think, a couple of exceptions like game reserves and whatever. But the idea was that everyone in South Africa would live under a capacitated, democratically elected local government, local council and local government system. This, I don't think, has shown itself to be a workable model. I think it's important, I think, to pull some things apart here. There are certainly places in South Africa, like Johannesburg, where mismanagement, corruption, incompetence, ineptitude, et cetera, has driven a decline. But there are also more than a few municipalities, you know, which about which you can legitimately ask the question: should they exist? Is there the capacity to have a municipal governance here, as it is envisaged elsewhere in the country? And this is what we're going to be talking about. We will be releasing a paper which I've spent a couple of months lovingly laboring on, sometimes not so lovingly, local government crises, decades in the making, and how to fix them, or how to address them. And I'm just going to throw out a bit of a teaser that in order to get local government right, we have to get a lot of other things right, possibly first or at least in tandem. Think about things like crime and criminality. When the local government system was introduced, the idea was that crime was a national competence, something the ANC was very firm on in the 90s, that it was not going to devolve policing power. Policing power was going to be something that it was going to keep under control. And also in the debates of the time, while there was certainly talk about corruption, the idea of crime as being a significant issue behind municipal failure was absent. I don't think you can get away from it now. If you want to introduce reforms either to an individual municipality or to the system as a whole, you are now going to be battling very well organized, entrenched, and very vengeful organized crime networks that are benefiting off this. Think about think, for example, about the various mafias, water, sanitation, and whatever. These are organizations or networks, or, you know, however you want to describe them, that have burrowed into the municipal tendering system, and their business model is dependent on governance not working. For the anarcho-capitalist inclined, I would say, don't celebrate the rapid collapse of the state too eagerly, because it's unlikely this is all going to be occupied by well-meaning civic groups. This is in Zanzi. You have guys with guns who will step in. So we'll be talking about that. We'll be talking about what a future system should look like, in my view, and with the support and perhaps also the opposition of some of those present. So look on our social media, look on our website. You can find the invitation, free to join, and we look forward to welcoming you. 12 o'clock on Thursday, done in conjunction with the Konrad Adenauer Foundation and the University of Free State.
Excellent stuff. Okay, let's move on to our next story. And this is a bit of an update on the chaos inside the ANC that's followed from the failure to submit certain candidates to the lists, to the IEC, to be elected as councillors in various municipalities. So it's been a little bit unclear up till now about the extent of this, how many people were affected, things like that. The language from the IEC is still a little bit confusing. The ANC is still insisting that during the process for amendments that the IEC will add these candidates. Whether that's going to happen or not, I think would be challenged in court if it does happen. The ANC is probably going to challenge it in court if it doesn't happen. So a lot of this is still up in the air, but we've gotten a couple of names of people who have apparently been left off of the candidate lists. And oh boy, is it embarrassing. So some key names that have been left off of the lists are people like Frank Chikane, possibly a possible contender for the ANC's mayoral candidate in Johannesburg. And then also NEC members, so that's members of the ANC's top decision-making body, Andile Lungisa and Nokwe Mafu, have both been left off of the list. This is really embarrassing for them because, I mean, Mafu is a deputy sport and arts and culture minister. Andile Lungisa is someone who I think should not be anywhere near power, considering that he, you know, that he violently assaulted someone in a council chamber, but let's not get hung up on that. But he's a prominent person within the ANC, and Frank Chikane is supposed to be the great hope of the ANC that's going to sweep into Johannesburg and hold Helen Zille back and, you know, make sure the ANC retains its dominance in that city. Terrence, what do you make of all this? This is getting more and more embarrassing.
Well, didn't Marx say something about how history repeats itself first as tragedy, then as farce? I don't know. I think in South Africa these days, it's hard to tell the two apart. My sense of this, and this is a hypothesis, is that what you're probably seeing is the outcome of internal factional battles and probably the inability to sort your list out, and you know, possibly even as a subsidiary consequence of that, you know, very embarrassing administrative errors. I agree with your assessment of Mr. Lungisa, and I think that there's a broader conversation to be had as to why South Africa's largest political party does not think that someone captured on camera beating an opponent over the head with a jug and having been sentenced to prison. I think he actually went to prison.
And then got let out super early on slightly shaky ground. Well,
but, you know, look, the thing is, this you know, we can't do the alleged thing here, you know, sorry, the court, you know, the courts have spoken, the video camcorder has spoken. I think the neurosurgeon had to speak. So I think it says something about the organization of our politics that this is not only your, you know, a candidate, but a, you know, mayoral candidate. There's something, there is something sinister about that, but be that as it may. Here's a provocative thought. I wonder if what you're seeing with Frank Chikane is merely a recognition of a reality. He has no intention to go to council. There was some chatter about 2 weeks ago that he was withdrawing. So perhaps he simply will not be there. But the ANC wants to at least try and use the Chikane adjacent dynamic to try and stump for some last minute support. I don't think it makes a great deal of sense. I don't think the ANC's campaign makes a great deal of sense.
Yeah. So on a technical note, you know, one shouldn't get too hung up on these big names because if you have proportional representation seats, you can remove whoever's on that list at a later date and then substitute in a new one as a political party. So if there really was a complete, you know, if these guys don't end up making it on the list despite being the mayoral candidates, the ANC could just get rid of one of its other PR candidates. Now, it gets a bit complicated because of the way our electoral system works. The ANC doesn't always have that many PR candidates in certain wards, which makes life complicated. But, you know, it still suggests to me that that's solvable. But when you start to look at some of the municipalities that have been affected, this gets much worse for the ANC. According to the reporting from Times Live, in Port St. John's, the ANC didn't submit, as far as I can tell, a single candidate. It says here they didn't submit 20 ward councillor candidates and they didn't submit 19 proportional representation candidates. Well, looking at Port St. John's, last time there are, in total in Port St. John's, there are 20 ward seats and 19 proportional representation seats. In other words, they submitted no one. What does that mean? Well, I guess that means the EFF is going to go from getting zero wards in this municipality that the ANC wins, like, you know, 70%, 80% of the vote in, to suddenly winning the entire municipality almost uncontested. It's just, it's kind of difficult to imagine how Fikile Mbalula, I think, can recover from this, because ultimately, as the head of the ANC's party machinery, this is his responsibility. And I think if he fails to become ANC president, this will be a very big reason why.
Sure. I think another municipality where the ANC has failed to field candidates is Mangaung, which means that though that those Ipsos results might not be that far off.
Yeah, it turns out the DA will win it, but not for the reasons the poll said.
Yeah, I think there's another issue that deserves noting at this point. You can the ANC has spoken about taking this to court and you know, performing various functions to get, you know, to get this overturned. The IEC has been very clear: no, you don't get to do that. Now, unless the ANC can show some sort of error on the IEC's part,
which they've claimed and the IEC has rejected.
Sure. It seems to me, and I think this has happened in the past, that they have failed to have their candidates registered on time, and the IEC has sort of found a way around it. Now, you can interpret that in various ways. The more benign interpretations that they reckon, well, ANC is the biggest party in the country, you can't really deny majority of people their democratic choice. The less benign one is, well, we're on side with the ANC and we want to make sure that they, so, you know, but let's just see that aside. I don't think the ANC has that sort of cachet now. That, you know, people in the IEC might well be thinking of what their careers look like post ANC dominance, and maybe you do have to work with, you know, you do have to show the blue people or whomever else, the red people perhaps, that you know, you aren't tainted by blood of green, black and gold.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you can't just ram something through in parliament to remove everyone in the IEC or to change the rules, because you don't have a parliamentary majority anymore.
Right.
And all the other parties, MK, I mean, if MK can submit its lists, the ANC really has no excuse. As we know, MK is very chaotic internally. So if they can do it, I think the ANC really should be ashamed.
MK kind of functions a bit like a merry-go-round at a fair. It's just like, you know, there's not enough little horses for the kids.
Yeah, if their councils are anything to, if their time in parliament has been anything to go by, whoever MK submits as council candidates will probably all be completely replaced in the next 3 months anyway, because that seems to be how MK works. But that's neither here nor there. So we'll have to see what happens. I think it's clear that unless the ANC can pull a rabbit out of a hat, that the IEC should stand firm on this one. I don't know. I think it's still, at the end of the day, it's just too damaging for the ANC to be able to let this one go. And I think they will twist every arm and pull every lever to try and remedy this, even if it means doing something very dodgy. Okay, let's move on to our last story for today. Now, I think we've had a lot of good stories today, but this one, it was just so kind of weird and crazy that we had to talk about it. According to a report in Rapport, senior military officers, you know, from the South African Armed Forces who were in Cuba for some sort of training thing, were apparently pressured to give quote-unquote voluntary donations, in this case of senior officers, of 15,000 rand each, in the case of junior officers, 3,000 rand each, to, quote, deserving and needy Cubans, although it's precisely what the money would be spent on was being extremely cagey. So these 38 South Africans had just arrived in Cuba for staff courses with Brigadier General Mitch Ledwaba of the military's personnel division. When he got them all into a room without the attaché being there and said, so you're all going, you should all give voluntary donations in dollars, according to your rank, to help the needy Cubans. He gave no explanation for what the money would be used for, and then promised that they would be reimbursed in December. But no proof of payment would be provided to the soldiers, and this all felt very dodgy. Some of the officers refused to pay, citing discomfort with the request and doubts that the money would be repaid. A lot of the soldiers who were attending this course had all been given a amount of dollars to live off for the whole year. So some of them worried that they just simply would run out of cash if they didn't give, if they gave some of the money away to begin with. A list was circulated on which each student who was attending had to enter their name and the amount they intended to donate. So a very dodgy situation. And Terence, this I think just reminds us of the extremely bizarre and intimate relationship that the ANC has with the Cuban government. What do you make of this?
I think that this is... this is somewhat more concerning than that. Cuba has been a significant recipient of South African aid in one way or another. I remember when they've had hurricanes, you know, there's been payments from South Africa out of the African Renaissance Fund, because we all know that Cuba is located in the Bight of Guinea, or the Gulf of Guinea. That is a sort of ideological obsession. I remember also in the 1990s reading a newspaper article that apparently there were something like 4 South African government delegations going to Cuba every month. You know, this, you know, provincial governments, different government departments, and so one of the problems was that they weren't informing one another. So, you know, you could just literally run into, you know, what concerns me about this is that this is the military. This isn't some sort of you know, party shindig. It's not even Durko. I mean, I think that would be, you know, to expect public servants to make this sort of contribution would be bad enough. But there's a rock solid principle which South Africa has generally, which has never been an issue in South Africa up to this point, that the military does not get involved in politics. And I think partly because the military is so underfunded, the idea of a military coup or, you know, military intervention has never been a thing. What we've seen over the last couple of years, senior officers kind of engaging in foreign policy on the fly. There's the guy who went to Iran, and
yes.
There's the BRICS naval exercises, apparently against President Ramaphosa's own instructions. Now all of these things seem to be occurring publicly, and they sort of all have one thing in common, that they place South Africa in a, well, they underline the kind of alignment of South Africa with regimes that are hostile to the United States. Look, remember, this isn't China, you know, where you sort of can't avoid it. Well, the Chinese don't need our money. They've got plenty of dollars of their own. We'd probably, like, you know, go and ask them for it, but and they wouldn't that sort of chuckle at us. But the point is, these are sort of discretionary relationships we have, which it seems are undertaken almost consciously to show defiance of the US. Now, if the presidency or Durko does that, that's one thing. I think it's short-sighted. When the military does that, that's that is not so much thumbing your nose at the at Donald Trump or the US or whatever. That's thumbing your nose at civilian control. We should be very worried about that.
I think, you know, when you have bits of money changing hands like this, and you consider that Cuba is under sort of this, I don't know, double the blockade. I mean, Cuba's been under blockade from the US for a long time, but it's, you know, under extra blockade now because there's this pressure campaign on Cuba. And you have, you know, South African military personnel flying in and then being told to just give money away. Now, who's getting that money? Maybe the officer involved is just pocketing all the things himself. I don't know. But maybe it's being funneled to people in the Cuban government to do certain things. And it's not huge sums of money, but it's also not completely nothing. It's all just very murky, and I think it warrants further investigation. And actually, it's the part of the problem is, you know, we can't get Parliament to investigate it because MK and the EFF, I think, are equally involved ideologically in the Cuba relationship as the ANC is. So there probably isn't a parliamentary majority to probably look into this, but there should be because there's clearly much that goes on behind the scenes here that I think is untoward. And you know, South Africa is not in a position to just be throwing around money and, I don't know, funding other countries where we struggle to look after ourselves.
Well, any final thoughts? Let me just challenge you on your choice of words. The Cuba is under a blockade of sorts now, but it was under an embargo, and I think this is the distinctions that drives me insane. There was no
there weren't ships blocking stuff coming into Cuba until
and
recently.
Basically, Cuba could trade with any country in the world apart from the US. Yes, and if you really wanted to trade with the US, apparently what you did was you set up a little company in Mexico or Canada, and you could do it like that. And there was a big lobby in the United States of vintage car aficionados who really wanted the blockade lifted because those in Cuba's just got this fleet of great stuff that they want to get their hands on. You know, you can find strange allies. Okay. As a sovereign state, South Africa is of course within its rights to conduct formal diplomatic relations. This, however, goes beyond that, and there is also something that I find deeply, deeply offensive, that you are kind of making soldiers who are there for professional development. You can argue whether Cuba is the best place to get it, but maybe there is may to stump up for a country whose political system, or who, you know, for which they may have no particularly warm feelings or maybe even negative feelings. And, you know, they've been given, you know, if you're going to be there for a year, Cuba has severe shortages. The one way you can actually get the stuff you need is
basically
through your dollar store. My own sense is that probably what will happen is that this is, and once again, this is just a hypothesis, is not so much that this is going to, you know, be handed over at a big ceremony to the Cuban president. But the kind of thing is, you know, you'll sort of have this envelope of dollars that you'll hand over to your corresponding general, you know, over some good Cuban rum and cohibas. And, oh, this is nice. I'll make sure this gets to the widows and orphans.
Just appalling stuff. This is I doubt anyone who could possibly benefit from this money in a real way is going to receive any of it. No. All right, let us close there. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you found the show interesting today. We will be back later this week. Thank you very much, everyone, and have a wonderful day. Cheers.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.